So today, you might say, is the Sermon on the Mount, but I'm going to take a different approach this time around. I know you all come here and you see amazing things. You come here every day of the week. You come here on Sunday morning. You come here and you fill your life up with wonderful gifts from this congregation. But I want to tell you about a thing you might not see all the time. Just a plain, old, ordinary day here at Brew. I want to tell you about a miraculous day. A day where things happened that changed lives. A day where conversations occurred that gave people hope they didn't know they had. Where help was offered to people who had nowhere else to go. It's a day you could write a novel about if you wanted to. It's a day that you could memorialize for history, a day that could give you reason to believe in places like this, even at your most cynical. A day that could make you believe a home for the spirit is something everyone should have, a day that could make you love this place. From the perspective I can share, this day starts as the minister, running a bit late, jingles her keys in the lock at the sanctuary door, announcing like the chiming of little bells that the day, at least for her, has begun. She makes her way down the aisle, admiring the sunlight streaming through the stained glass windows. The pews, already warmed by that light, smell like good wood and old polish. And the corner where the Christmas tree stands in December still clings to a few odd needles, gentle reminders of a quiet night some months ago where we gathered by candlelight and sang of a silent night. It is morning at Brew, the beginning of the workday. And by the time this minister has plopped down her purse, heavy footsteps from a tiny woman echo through the hallway, where a ringing soprano voice calls out, "Hello!" And Elise Hastings makes her appearance in the church office. The two talk for a minute, exchange their messages and good wishes, promise that they will meet by 10 o'clock to plan worship. Anise is always ready by 10, the minister not so much. Tina Cox, the administrative assistant, comes in and switches on the copier, which proceeds to make a strange and unearthly noise. Before anyone has had the chance to catch their breath or worry about the groanings emerging from the copy machine, a middle-aged man comes in off the street clutching everything he owns in a soggy canvas bag. He's been in and out of jail, you see, for these last 15 years. He's HIV positive, and he's worked his way through every step he knew to take to get this far alive. 15 years HIV positive and living much of it on and off the streets is a long haul. He spent these last few months living on the streets of Manassas, and he's made it longer than anybody ever expected him to. He's come here to this place today because he knows he is safe here. In fact, he knows he is not only safe, but welcome. He knows that the nice ladies who work here won't judge him or mock him or try to convert him to anything. He knows that their help does not come with a demand that he attend their church on Sunday. He's not sure exactly what these uni-uni-whatevers believe, or even if they're really Christians, but he knows they're good to him. He knows that they feed him, and he knows that when they can, they help pay for his prescriptions. And they're a place where he can come and be safe and get what he needs to get through. Tina, that nice lady at the desk, knows his grandmother and lectures him regularly about what his grandmama would want him to do. She knows his family. She even knew the house he grew up in before they tore it down all those years ago. It's a small world, and in this place it feels even smaller, which is part of why he likes it so much. So they give him food, and they pay for some of his medications, and he goes on his way. By this time, the crowd in the church office has swelled from the solid core of three to a roving band of something between 5 and 15. Somebody is already working on the copier. Mary and Michelle and Lynn and Lisa are talking 1,000 miles a minute in the religious education office as they plan the next fifth Sunday children's program and hope that they'll get enough volunteers for the activity room this month. Their work is punctuated by laughter and purposeful pauses, and somehow the cacophony of it all makes you know that with them on the job is gonna get done. The Mothers and Children's Chalice Group met yesterday, and they brought pastries. So the people move in and out of the office, gathering in clusters of 2 to 10 around the croissants, and imagining that a quarter of one really doesn't have calories anyway. The minister and the music director are down the hall picking out hymns for the next 2 weeks, worship themes for the next 6 months, and in between all of that, they're dreaming up a theme for the next Friday Evensong service and catching up with one another on all the urgent needs in the life of the church. Someone's in the hospital. Someone else just seems sad. Somebody's going to have a baby, and somebody decided they were ready to sing their first solo. In our office, that's like announcing you're ready to have a baby. They laugh together. They praise the people for their courage. They divvy up the phone calls while more people make the short walk back and forth to the food pantry. And when the minister turns to leave, the piano starts to play as next Sunday's music takes shape under nimble fingers. Meanwhile, a member of the congregation has suffered a loss. He's remembered in this loss how alone he feels in this place and this time in his life. He's realized all in one moment how hard it is to stand before the world and its challenges with no family left to catch him, to hold him. And he's called the only place he knows to call right now, his church. The minister meets him in her office and nods her head while he does all the work. While he tells himself exactly what he needs to hear and finds within his own heart wisdom he didn't know he had, she only listens and watches as a grace beyond the two of them creeps into that room and fills it up with hope. And he leaves 45 minutes later, not sure what happened, or if all that nodding is what's meant by pastoral care. But knowing for a fact that he feels better and braver for it, and that he might just be ready to face the day and his life after all. And the minister remembers for a moment before she returns to her beckoning email what all this church stuff is about in the first place, and says a tiny prayer of thanksgiving because this is the work we were made to do. And this is why we need one another. And this is why she loves her job. By now, the copier is fixed. And someone has come in to fumigate the kitchen. And someone else is down in the boiler room making sure it's in safe working order. Meanwhile, from the exercise studio above their heads, the sound of belly dancing music kicks in. And a half a dozen perfectly respectable ladies start shimmying in the late morning light, learning all over again what it is to love being in their own bodies. In the office, a little girl with glitter in her hair and glue on her hands walks up to every single person there, including the homeless guy waiting to use the phone, and personally delivers pictures she has drawn, saying to each and every one, "I made this for you because I love you." Or as the minister describes when doing impressions of this little girl that night, "I made this for you because I love you." And it is only noon. All of this. And it is only noon. And this is not a special day. This is not a particular day plucked out of all other days for its fabulousness. On an everyday, average, normal day at Brew, you could just call this Tuesday, or Wednesday, or Thursday, all of these miracles, and it is nothing more grandiose than a morning. Nothing more magnificent than a regular old morning among people who live and work in this place. It is just a day, like any other day, jam-packed with miracles of the common variety, overflowing with grace. Just a plain old ordinary day where we're grateful that the lights were on and the heat was on and the people were here. A day that we make possible because we believe and we show it with our gifts that this place matters in the world. A day that could not have happened, like all the thousands of similar days before it and after it, if we didn't have the commitment to keep the lights on, the hope alive in this precious place. The little girl who handed over her gifts said, "I made this for you because I love you." And she offered those pictures of hers willingly. She was proud and glad to offer, not because her gift would be used to promote her pet project, not because her gift would be used to decorate her particular favorite door or refrigerator, but because she loved these people and she thought she had something to give. "I give this to you because I love you." And it is in this spirit, knowing that we make possible 1,000 tiny miracles, that we are asked to give what we can to our congregation. We are a community of free searchers, bound together by a history that we can't run away from, a common message that we speak without being forced, and a fellowship that holds each and every person responsible for tending the light of the whole. "I give this to you because I love you." When at the end of the month your canvasser calls, know that they call not to get your cash, but because they love this congregation. And they ask no more of you than to consider how you might tend its light in the many, many ways of which you are capable. Every day, tiny miracles of the common variety happen because our congregation exists. Every day, lives change because we have one another. Every ordinary day is a truly holy day here among us. Friends, I give this to you because I love you. Let us all ask ourselves only that question as we go forward in beloved community together. May it be so, and amen.